case number 25351, United States versus Burdick.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Trial attorney Arun Bodapati on behalf of the government. The district court erred when it suppressed a loaded firearm that officers recovered from the appellee's pocket while responding to an emergency 911 call stating that a man with his exact description, a yarmulke, an army fatigue shirt, glasses, and a purple bandana around his wrist had been threatening her co-tenants and saying he had a gun. When officers arrived on the scene, they saw the appellee leaving for another street, and the 911 caller confirmed just 20 seconds later that he left as soon as he saw the officers coming. When the officers began speaking with him, he contradicted himself, lying about whether he had a gun, lying about whether he was licensed to ever have a gun. And he suggested he could go into his home to get a license that was in his pocket the entire time. When he finally pulled that license out of his pocket, he had to move a black plastic bag that he had been holding against his right leg pocket for nearly the entire conversation. And when Lieutenant Van Zanten finally saw that pocket, he noticed that it was unusually heavy. And in light of his training and experience, he reasonably and correctly suspected that it had the gun inside.
Does he have to suspect at that point that the individual has a gun or that the individual has a gun and is dangerous?
Well, he does have to suspect both that the individual has a gun and it's dangerous, but it necessarily follows, I think, that the suspect could potentially be dangerous if he's been accused both of having a gun and threatening other people just 10 minutes earlier with the potential of using that gun.
So your description of the facts that you just gave us was the characterization that the government advocated below. The district court made various findings and made findings that there was nothing particularly evasive about the individual rounding the corner and heading back to what appeared to be his home when the police arrived, that he wasn't actually being evasive in his answers. They were understandable misunderstandings to the extent that there was what you would describe as a contradiction. Are we bound by those, or what's our standard for those?
No, Your Honor, the standard is de novo, because when we're talking about whether these behaviors could be viewed as evasive or innocent, those are inferences to be drawn from the fact. They're the legal analysis of the facts. And reasonable suspicion is a lenient test that is viewed from the perspective of an objective law enforcement officer.
So wait a minute, I want to make sure I understand this, because you know it happens more and more. That we are reviewing events that are documented with videos.
Yes.
And the district court will have made findings about what we see on the video.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding was that we reviewed the district court's findings for clear error. And you're telling me we review it de novo. And I'm wondering, can you point me to a case that sort of tells us that?
To clarify, Your Honor, findings of fact are reviewed for clear error, but mixed questions of law and fact are reviewed de novo under decisions of this court like Weaver and Patterson.
So is the question of whether somebody's being evasive a mixed question, or is that a factual finding?
The issue is whether the facts found by the district court reasonably support reasonable suspicion or not. That's a legal determination of reasonable suspicion.
No, I understand that, but one of the facts is were his answers evasive, right? Mm-hmm. That was characterized in a sort of factual way, and that finding would have implications. You know, it would be another pebble on the scale or not on the reasonable suspicion. And so, is it your view that the district court's findings that he wasn't being evasive are we don't consider them at all, and we review the video ourselves and decide whether he was evasive?
Well, the court can review the video itself, but I don't believe that that's really the question here. As this court put it in Padilla, conduct that is as consistent with innocence as with guilt can still form the basis for reasonable suspicion, because you're viewing the facts from the perspective of an objective law enforcement officer. And all he has to do is specifically articulate why he could consider that conduct reasonably suspicious under the totality of the circumstances.
Could you address the anonymous call? Sure. I was concerned about the district court's treatment of it, but I was also a little confused by the record. That person didn't give a name, but did give a callback number, and then the dispatcher called back either once or twice, and all the officers could hear the conversation describing the individual, Mr. Burvick, and then as he turned the street, also describing the threats that the caller made. Were there two calls or three calls? Could you help me with that?
No problem, Your Honor. So first, there was a 911 call that was relayed by the dispatcher to the officers. That is not captured on the body camera footage. When the officers arrived on the scene, they asked the dispatcher to call the 911 caller back. And that's what you can hear on the body camera footage. And you can hear the dispatcher relaying what the 911 caller told her to the officers on that body camera footage. And you also have the audio of that follow-up 911 call at 249 in the appendix.
So you hear the relay by the dispatcher, but there's a continued call. Because it seemed to me, I was a little concerned about whether this was truly an anonymous call, yep, or whether there were enough indicia given the callback number. I think she said her name was D, yep, ultimately. And you find those important. Counsel for the defense says this is still really just an anonymous call.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. This was not a truly anonymous caller, and that's pursuant to this court's decision in Elmore. To give two examples, for example, in the First Circuit's decision in Ruiz Diaz, it said that a caller wasn't truly anonymous where, even though he didn't provide his name, he did provide a phone number and agreed to speak with officers if needed. So here we have the phone number that was given to officers. We have her responding to the dispatcher's call. And we can also see Officer DeGuano, one of the three officers, calling her as they walk to Burvick on McDonough Street. So we have the caller making herself available multiple times.
So and what's the test for a 911 call? I mean, the indicia of reliability. We look at just similar to the totality of circumstances?
It is a totality of the circumstances analysis. And we can start with the Supreme Court's decision in Navarette, which addresses calls that are purely anonymous. What the Supreme Court said there were that there are four factors that can support the reliability of even a purely anonymous call. First is the use of the 911 system, which is itself an indicator of veracity. The second is alleged eyewitness knowledge that can be corroborated by the officers. Third is a report of contemporaneous observations, which have long been treated as especially reliable. And fourth is the claim of an ongoing emergency, which decreases the need for pre-response corroboration because of the potential risks that someone could be harmed in the interim.
The ongoing emergency, does that have to be a crime in progress? So in Navarette, there was allegedly a drunk driver that was still on the road, and that is the ongoing emergency. Yes. Here, there was a report of somebody threatening, it seemed to be now in the past, and saying he had a gun, but not disclaiming that a gun was actually seen.
Yeah, officers do not necessarily need to find the suspect caught in the act of committing the crime, and that follows from this court's decision in Simmons. Consider the description there. This court stated that the officers were responding to a call reporting an assault in progress, possibly involving a gun. When the officers arrived, it said that they did not find evidence of the assault in progress, but what they did find was that a suspect matched the exact description provided and was in the location that the caller stated he would be. And that was enough to justify an investigatory stop in light of the reported conduct that was at issue.
When you are doing the totality of the circumstances analysis, and there's a couple of junctures here where one might do it, the time of if there was an initial investigatory stop, when did it take place, and also the timing of the hands-on search. When you do that, once you get information that's potentially inculpatory, that suggests that this individual is engaged in criminal conduct, is that impervious to the totality analysis as it unfolds with subsequent interaction?
It is not impervious, Your Honor. The totality of the circumstances is always a developing thing in progress. Certain factors can cut against it, and certain factors could cut in favor of finding the inculpatory explanation.
So if they had reasonable suspicion at the moment they arrived at the scene, but then we see that the individuals at the scene say, I haven't seen anybody threatening anybody, and we have findings that there was no evasive conduct, and that he came to the officers when summoned and didn't behave in a suspicious manner and was calm, does that, I guess, doesn't that undermine to some extent whatever weight you might give to the initial report suggesting that there was somebody who might be committing the crime?
Not really, Your Honor. It may affect the totality of the circumstances to a limited extent, but it's always important to bear in mind that reasonable suspicion is a lenient test that requires less than a preponderance of the evidence and less than even a fair probability of wrongdoing. And it is always viewed from the perspective of an objective law enforcement officer who does not need to rule out potentially innocent explanations for the conduct that he could reasonably view as suspicious. Placed against that low bar, here there was more than enough reason for Lieutenant Van Zanten to suspect that Berbick was armed and dangerous, as he ultimately turned out to be.
What was the crime of which he was suspected, based on the report?
According to the radio code that the officers were responding to, was for threats. And as the narrative showed, it was that
harassment,
he,
right? Was that the...
So it's called Other Crimes in Progress, Harassment, Other Threats.
Okay.
So it embraces threats. And as you can see in the narrative description, it was that the individual who was identified was threatening tenants with a firearm, threatening people saying he has a gun.
No, wasn't threatening with a firearm. He was threatening them and saying he had a firearm.
Well, the narrative actually has two lines. One of them says, threatening people saying he has a gun. And then the subsequent line says, threatening tenants with a firearm. So the officers are acting on the information that they're getting. And, you know, they have to sort of analyze that on the ground in fast-developing circumstances.
I'm sorry, the threatening with a gun, that appears exactly where? Where are you quoting?
This will be in page 113 of the appendix. And that's the 911 report that relays what the dispatcher would have told the officers.
Okay. So I'm sorry, just to clarify, that is, those are the words that the dispatcher would have used describe to the officers what was happening.
Yeah. As Van Zanten said, in sum and substance, that would have been accurate. Yeah.
Well, I see two things. I'm looking at the page. Thank you for having that cite in your head. So the first one says threatening, saying he has a gun. And then the second is threatening tenants with a firearm, no firearm shown. Yeah. Right, that's part of the same line.
Yeah.
So I think you pulled out the threatening with a firearm, but it's important to me, I think, that no firearm shown is part of that same statement.
Sure. But, Your Honor, I would point out that no firearm was shown in Simmons, where this court upheld the legitimacy of a stop.
I'm just wanting to make sure we're accurately characterizing the facts. I'm not necessarily drawing a legal conclusion.
Yeah, sure, Your Honor. I would point out that whether a firearm is shown or not does not necessarily impact the analysis, we believe, in a serious way. Because you can still threaten people by saying that you have a firearm. It still raises the risk that that firearm could be used to hurt the people you're threatening.
Thank you, counsel. You've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Berbick was slowly walking to his front door when police commanded him to come and talk to them. He was so cooperative that the officer thought that 911 call may not have been truthful. Officers asked questions, he answered them. They asked for two IDs, he provided them. He was calm, direct, cooperative. The district court's finding suppressing the evidence was on two independent grounds that were correct. She found that there was no reasonable suspicion to seize him and no reasonable suspicion that he was armed and dangerous. The government, in their presentation, largely relies on factual disputes, as Your Honor has pointed out. Those disputes are reviewed for clear error, and that includes findings like evasive or that the bag was normally held at the leg. The Supreme Court has explained that clear error standard applies to those factual inferences in our visu. There's no clear error here.
Can I ask, isn't there a difference between facts that are sort of objective and facts that are subjective? So if someone says a bag is hanging naturally, that seems like something that is up for grabs, whereas a bag hanging straight vertically is something that is more objective. Is that not a consideration in how we review findings of fact?
That's not how the Supreme Court described it in Arvizu. The Supreme Court talked about abnormal versus normal as being a factual finding deserving deference, which seems very similar to natural versus unnatural. And these factual findings are also amply supported by the testimony and the record.
Could you talk about the 911 call? It seems to me that the district court may have been a little too quick to dismiss it as an anonymous call, whereas this had some indicia of reliability that has been credited about, you know, in factors that have been credited in the past, such as the callback number, giving a name, ultimately having an ongoing conversation, also showing that the person was able to see the defendant turning the corner. So a continued involvement rather than a random kind of abrupt and brief encounter. Would you agree that the court was entitled and should take those into account in assessing reasonable suspicion?
The court did take those things into account. The court ultimately, in the totality of the circumstances, found it wasn't enough, especially when the suspicion that they may have had when they arrived dissipated, and the officer testifies to that, and that is reasonable. But to answer Your Honor's question about anonymity in particular, the caller here refused to give her name. The finding with respect to whether D was a name or not, the court does not make a finding that that's
But what about the callback number?
That's
the callback number. Doesn't that suggest that the person is traceable?
Well, not really, Your Honor. Perhaps the district court, I think, correctly says that there is some indication that they could, that the 911 caller was willing to continue to engage, and the court considered that in the totality of the circumstances. Here, though, we have a 911 caller that still has not been identified. And one of the normal indicia of reliability is that the address pops up in the 911 report, too. Her address was miles from the location of the complaint, something the government didn't explain and suggests is a counterindication of whether or not she was there at that moment.
Could you also speak to armed and dangerous? The district court seemed to rely on the calm with which the police proceeded, as is evident on the videos, as suggesting that they weren't really concerned. They didn't really think that the defendant was dangerous. Is that the correct approach, do you believe?
So the district court gave an extremely well, thorough opinion that included all factors. That was a very small part that bolstered her opinion in the totality of the circumstances, but she repeatedly stated the correct standard, that it is an objective test, and that what the officers were subjectively doing just supported that there was no reasonable indication that he was armed and dangerous.
Another thing that caught my attention was the district court said that the officers displayed their firearms, whereas I saw holstered firearms on the video. I didn't see any removed from the holster or brandished in any way. I saw that one of the officers touched his firearm at one point. But is that having holstered firearms, where most police officers, I suppose, are armed on the street responding to an emergency call like that, is that a factor that should bear on the district court's analysis?
Well, the way the court described that factor, yes, because what she said was that the officer had his hand placed on top of the firearm almost entirely throughout the encounter, which is borne out by the officer's testimony and the video. So I agree it's not brandished, but it is more than merely walking around with an officer talking and the gun just merely there as you would see on the street. So that's one of many factors. Importantly, the district court considered factors that the government ignores, including that Mr. Burvick was commanded at the outset of the interaction to come out from right in front of his home where he was about to go into his door and come talk to the officers.
So you believe he was commanded, he was coerced to come out, not that he consented to come out? Wasn't he invited to come out?
No, the officer testified that he commanded him to come out. The officer had said the same thing to prosecutors earlier, closer in time.
This is another one of these fact questions. I mean, we listen to the audio and the voice goes up. He says, sir, you know, come here a second, or something, you know, it goes up. I don't know if that was a good imitation of it, but I think we would normally consider that a question. But do we accept it? Is that a clear error issue for, you know, since the district court said it was a command?
Well, it is a standard of clear error, and it's certainly not clear error when the officer testified, I commanded him, and I was shocked that he complied with my command. When you have testimony supporting, direct testimony supporting the court's decision, that can't be clear error. That's not even two permissible views of the evidence. It's exactly what the testimony shows, and how she found the video to describe. And the government doesn't dispute that finding at all. The government just acts like it hasn't happened.
You were going to say why it mattered that that he was inside, that Mr. Griffith was inside his gate. If this had happened 2 seconds earlier, before he entered the gate, would the legal analysis have been different? And if so, why?
Well, not the district court's legal analysis. I'm not meaning to get into the curtilage issue, but the fact that he is walking towards his home just steps away.
Why does it matter if you're not going to get into the curtilage issue? I thought that's the only significance of this.
Because that is a factor in why any suspicion has dissipated at that moment. Not only is there no ongoing emergency, not only is Mr. Burbick calm, cooperative, standing in one spot, answering questions, he also was on his way home. Nothing clearly is occurring. There is no emergency at that moment. So I think
Can I back up to before we get to dissipation, I understand that to be sort of an alternative argument, that even if there was reasonable suspicion for 911 call, it was dissipated by the time he was trying to go home or later in the interaction. But on the 911 call itself, Judge Carney was just asking about that, and I wanted to follow up. I mean, you have the report of someone saying that there's someone yelling, threatening people, saying he has a handgun or saying he has a gun, and maybe the note, it seems ambiguous. It wasn't seen, but unclear whether he had one. He was saying he had one. That's not an emergency. That's not an ongoing emergency.
No, Your Honor. The caller is very clear that no gun is shown. The caller is explaining that that's not what has happened, which is important.
What if there was the shape of a gun through a pocket? Maybe somebody was threatening that way. So no gun shown, but at least pretending or representing that there is a gun.
I think it's unlikely the 911 caller would specify explicitly that there was no gun shown if the 911 caller thought they had seen one. So those are not the facts we have. Navarette is described by the Supreme Court as a close case for whether it is an emergency. And as I believe it was Your Honor who pointed out, drunk driving is an ongoing crime. It is something that is continuing and the driver is on the road. It's not something that would just stop that next moment unless perhaps the person had parked the car, which did not happen there. Here, there is nothing.
In your view, the gun has to be clearly visible or reported to be so for there to be an ongoing emergency.
No, it's not a totality test, right? It's not a bright line rule like that, but here we know that there was no gun shown, and then when the officers arrived, all is calm.
How many minutes had passed between the 911 call and the officers' encounter? 5 minutes, six minutes?
Approximately 10, Your Honor. And when they arrive, there's nothing happening at the location. The person who is there has no knowledge, says, no, I didn't see anything of that. And when they see Mr. Burbick walking into his home, he is walking slowly. He is extremely cooperative with the officers.
So if the caller had seen a gun and said he was waving a gun around, and yet 10 minutes passed and the gun was nowhere to be seen and no threatened person was nearby, would you say that any emergency had dissipated by then and the officers were not entitled to confront him and question him?
That would certainly be significantly different in that this court has case law when a gun is brandished in the streets that does create a danger.
But why wouldn't that dissipate also if he's acting calm and just going home?
It might, Your Honor, but I think that would be a much more difficult case than the one that we have here. What we have here is no one...
Why for dissipation purposes? I don't understand why that makes a difference if the argument is that whatever was happening 5 minutes, 6 minutes ago is no longer happening now. If there was a gun, it is not there present. If there was threatening, it's not happening anymore. Isn't that the reason?
That's part of the reason, Your Honor, but it's also that the original call is not at the level, it's not an emergency. Nobody describes it as such. It is something that the caller is asking police to help with, but it's not an immediate danger. The officers are responding to a harassment complaint, as Your Honor points out. That's what the officer testifies to. And they are doing their job in responding to the complaint and then noting that their reasonable suspicion has dissipated. Mr. Burbick, in fact, consents to a search when he is stopped initially, which shocked the officer as well. Nothing that happens after he is stopped raises the suspicion. In fact, it all decreases the suspicion all the way up to when he is searched.
Can I ask, I know you're over your time, but the seizure, when that exactly occurred, I think your position is that it occurred at the time of turning over his license or the request to turn over the license, and I'm wondering if you could explain why, and particularly in light of the fact that he refused, as you just mentioned, the search before that, and then after that refused to show the second phone. That seems to indicate that he was aware that he could refuse the officer's requests or commands.
His refusals are actually at the officer's invitation. So he is aware once the officer says, oh, you can refuse the search, and he says, okay. And as the district court points out, that's really almost another example of him just going along with what he thinks he's supposed to do. So that is not evidence that he felt free to leave. The district court found that the moment that it's the security license that is turned over, not the ordinary driver's license. She says that at the latest, that's the seizure. And that's correct. And she looks
but
at...
why is that so if even after that, he later in the interaction said, no, I refuse? That seems to indicate that he's now aware that he does that these are voluntary commands or requests.
He's aware of the limited ability to refuse to a search because the officer has told him. And so he's continuing with what the officer told him. That's not the analysis about whether a reasonable person would feel free to leave, which is what this court has to consider.
But you've hooked the analysis to the request for the license, and that's if it seems to suggest before and after the refusal that he could have refused that as well. So why is that the time at which it becomes a seizure?
I don't see a search the same as refusing to turn over your license. Those are different things. But the reason that is the moment I believe the district court chose was looking at the totality of the circumstances. So he's commanded to come out of the area right in front of his home to the sidewalk. And that's an important factor because that is one that is absent from all of the cases cited by the government where there is no seizure. In those cases, Drayton and the line of them, the courts explicitly note that there's no command as a factor in support of the lack of seizure. So there's the command. Then there is detailed questioning that goes beyond basic biographical information. There's accusatory questioning. And those questions relate to his security guard license. Then his property is taken by taking that license.
Could you clarify one thing? He had produced his driver's license first, and then the security guard license was a second additional question.
It's the opposite, actually. So they have this line of questioning, the accusatory questioning about the 911 call, what he had been doing, and then about his status as a security guard and whether he has a gun. So they ask for that license first. It's later in the interaction they ask for the driver's license. So that's also an unusual factor. The government says asking for ID is a standard thing officers can do, but that's not what happens here. They ask for his security license after commanding him to come out, after his calm presentation, after he answers these accusatory questions. And then at that moment when he has to hand over property, the court says at the latest that he is seized.
Well, why, if they hadn't asked for ID yet, and that was the proxy, they didn't have his driver's license first, why wasn't that asking for a license government says?
Well,
just asking for ID.
I don't think the government is suggesting that. It's not a proxy. The security guard license is connected to whether or not he has a license to have a gun. It's directly related to the accusatory questions.
So
it can't
serve as ID.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
It wouldn't serve just as asking for an ID.
Correct, Your Honor, which I believe is why they ask for the ID later in the interaction. So at the moment when they ask the license, it's not the security license, it's not the same as just having a friendly conversation with somebody and asking for their driver's license. This is nothing like that sort of case. Additionally, that's just for the seizure. More is needed for the search. As Judge Robinson points out, they also need to believe he's armed and dangerous and to reasonably believe that. There's nothing additional to suggest that at all. Heaviness in a pocket, especially in a cargo pants pocket, which is fairly bulky, to find that is enough would go past this court's previous case law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up on the point of the seizure, we would disagree on a few counts. First of all, whether you characterize Van Zanten's initial request to come here as a command or a request, that alone did not create a seizure, and the district court didn't find that. So in order to establish that there was a seizure, there would need to be some additional factors that happened after the fact, and we just don't have those here. A counsel for the appellee suggested
that... You're not disputing that when they grabbed the leg, that that's...
That is certainly a seizure, Your Honor. Okay. Yes. Yeah. The appellee suggested that somehow asking accusatory questions can increase the coerciveness of an encounter, and that going beyond basic biographical questions raises that coerciveness. But that's inconsistent both with this court's decisions in Lee and Hooper and the Supreme Court's decisions in Drayton and Bostick. In fact, one of those decisions explicitly states that officers can ask incriminating questions without converting it into a seizure.
One of the things that sort of, and I don't know whether this is sort of an incriminating question, or it struck me and nobody's really focused on it, but and it was around the time of asking for the security license. He says, well, if somebody thinks I was waving a gun around accusing people, why wasn't I arrested? And they said, well, that's why we're here. Right? That strikes me as suggesting you're not free to go.
Well, no, Your Honor, because at multiple points during the conversation, Lieutenant Van Zanten also says, well, we're here to investigate. The caller could be wrong, but we have to investigate and find out what the facts are. And he says that at multiple points during the body camera footage. Now, briefly to turn to another point, I just want to reiterate that this is not really a question of facts as found by the district court, but about the weight that was given to them. Counsel for the appellee suggested that Arvizu is what controls here. But Arvizu held exactly the opposite of what the appellee's arguing here. Specifically, when reversing the suppression there, the Supreme Court made this observation. The court appeared to believe that each observation by the officer that was itself readily susceptible to an innocent explanation was entitled to no weight. Terry, however, precludes this sort of divide-and-conquer analysis. And it's that exact sort of divide-and-conquer analysis that we see in the district court's decision here. Consider, for example, at page 228 of the appendix, when the district court says, Burvick's holding of the plastic bag by his side in a natural arm position was objectively consistent with innocent explanations and does not give rise to reasonable suspicion. We know that that's not the standard. Similarly, when the district court said that Burvick's answers to Lieutenant Van Zanten's questions were plausible and responsive,
well,
and therefore...
When you say that's not the test, I mean, at the threshold, it may be part of a totality, but you have to decide whether there was something suspicious about the way he was holding the bag.
Yes.
And if there wasn't, then whether it's as a factor in itself or as part of a totality, it wouldn't incrementally add to the totality if there was nothing suspicious about it.
Yeah. But here it could. And again, the question is whether there could be a suspicious explanation, even if another innocent explanation could also apply. And Lieutenant Van Zanten articulated a specific reason why he could consider the holding of the bag suspicious, which is that it was hiding the weighted pocket that had the gun behind it during the entire conversation. So the question is, in that sort of a tiebreaker thing, where there is an inculpatory inference and an innocent explanation, we ask whether an objective law enforcement officer could credit the inculpatory explanation under the totality of the circumstances. And that's what we have here, because he was responding to a 911 call about an individual making threats with a gun. The individual provided inconsistent, contradictory answers about whether he had a gun or could ever have a gun. And he used that black plastic bag to hide the noticeably heavy pocket that ultimately did have the gun. So all of these circumstances have to be evaluated in their totality rather than in isolation. And rather than considering whether each of those individualized circumstances is susceptible of an innocent explanation. And that demonstrates the flaws in the district court's analysis here.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both. We'll take the case under advisement. The next argument will be in case number 242211 and 25662, Lanesboro 2000 LLC versus Nextres. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. The Federal Arbitration Act unambiguously directs that arbitration awards must be vacated where fundamental fairness is violated as to preserve the integrity and continuing vitality of arbitration. Here, the district court failed to ensure fundamental fairness upon three grounds. First, whereas the district court correctly held that the arbitrator exceeded his authority in hearing and issuing the injunctive awards, the court erred by failing to give effect to such holding by confirming the award, which repeatedly and improperly accorded law of the case treatment to the injunctive awards, and thus eschewed a trial on all issues. Whereas the district court held that the arbitrator did nothing more than give consideration to the entire record of the case from its inception, in actuality, these injunctive awards were not entitled to law of the case treatment due to their exigent, interim, and emergency nature, which is an offense to due process, as injunctions inherently deprive a non-movement of an opportunity to adequately prepare, marshal proof, and test both the veracity of adverse witness testimony and the genuineness of documentary proffers under the rigors of cross-examination.
But before we get further into the merits or demerits of the arbitral award, could you address the motion to dismiss and the apparent waiver in the arbitration agreement that your client drafted and that was signed or agreed to by both parties? The waiver, as you know, says the parties hereby freely waive the right to trial by judge or jury, the right to appeal, pretrial discovery, and application of the rules of evidence, all of which strikes me as we're not going into court except to the extent that the law requires it. And the law in Heft, we said, does require that in order for the courts to be used to enforce arbitral awards. But it looks to me as though the parties waived their right to an appeal of the district court's review of the arbitral decision. And to the extent that that is ambiguous, it seems to me that gets construed against your client. So tell me where I'm wrong in my thinking about this, please.
Well, Your Honor, as to the ambiguity and construction, both parties are sophisticated individuals. I mean, this is a construction company.
Well, then start with the plain meaning. The plain meaning says the parties hereby freely waive the right to appeal. And there's no reference to the original appellate arbitration rules. Oh, the AAA stuff is addressed in the prior paragraph, arbitration disputes. So there's no reference to the optional appellate arbitration rules, which I take it from your papers is what you were arguing, that that waiver of the right to appeal has to do the arbitral, the AAA appeal. But all of the language around the waiver has to do with trial by judge or jury, pretrial discovery, application of the rules of evidence, which suggests to me from the context that it was a judicial appeal after district court confirmation or failure to confirm the arbitral award. So again, please help me.
Yes, Your Honor, of course. I think reasonable minds can differ on that. Here in the context, trial by judge or jury, pretrial discovery, application of rules of evidence, these all consider things before AAA, not before the district court. The district court has an independent obligation to ensure due process and fundamental fairness, and this court's decisions in...
I'm not following. These are all things that you get in court, but not in arbitration, aren't they?
No, Your Honor.
Trial by judge or jury, right to appeal, pretrial discovery, rules of evidence... Those are things you get in court, but not arbitration.
These are all things you get at a trial level, Your Honor. Okay. Whether you have a jury, I mean, obviously it's unlikely in arbitration.
I thought your argument is that these are... Why don't you continue?
Tell me what, if you don't mind.
I thought your argument is that the right to appeal is limited to AAA appeals.
Well,
and
that's for
sure.
I
don't understand how that makes sense. If the common aspect of all of these items is that they are things that you get in court.
Well, in the context of an arbitration agreement, rules of evidence, trial, pretrial discovery, those are all things that would be before AAA in the context of this arbitration agreement. So we think this meant AAA's arbitration process. Now, notably, We haven't appealed the arbitration. We've appealed the district court's confirmation order, reconsideration order, judgment, and impermissible enlargements of the arbitration award. So we think there is no waiver, and in any event, all of Heft, DH Blair, Zurich American, and Agility Warehousing, this court's precedents all say that you cannot just waive judicial review of an arbitration award.
Well, Heft speaks to a district court's review of an arbitration award to make sure it's consistent with the FAA. You have a chance to say that there was misconduct by the arbitrator, there was fraud or collusion, and it said that you can't, that the federal courts can't be used through the confirmation process or for a waiver of the confirmation process to, merely rubber stamp an arbitral award and all the enforcement mechanisms still be employed. So it seems to me that Heft is limited.